Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Kostura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of August 12th, 2024. So just like we always typically talk about here, there was a DFIR report that came out, and this one was kind of interesting. Most DFIR reports usually are breach related, and they kind of walk through kind of like a start to finish breach, which is really insightful, especially if you're kind of new to the game, understanding the data, understanding what to look for, understanding potentially how to hunt for it as well. They do a great kind of start to finish. So I always recommend that type of reporting for people that are like, how do I break into threat hunting? What do I look at? I just use that as a great example. But this report specifically, it's called Threat Actors Toolkit Leveraging Sliver PoshC2 Batch Scripts. They basically discovered, I want to say it was December 2023, basic HTTP server that simple HTTP server. It's basically a Python run web server. We use it a lot in the lab. When we were practice moving payloads to simulate kind of like that attack, drop tools, move things, that kind of stuff. The actor had them set up publicly, you know, they're openly available, and they were hosting their tools on the servers. So what was interesting is when they discovered this server where these actors were hosting their tools and scripts and things, they kind of just kept an eye on it to see, well, how active is it? And they even saw where things were being updated, moved, changed. Through over the course of the months, even up to August this month. So it's interesting how active they were. Now, the other interesting thing is they did tie, based on some of the artifacts and things they pulled out and the server itself, the two IP addresses, which is interesting because they tie directly back to the geolocation of Moscow and Russia. And, you know, it's something I've commonly heard from people that in the intel type community, that sometimes criminal activists, especially that are kind of, you know, being safeguarded by operating within Russia, as well as even some Russia government driven things, are a little brazen sometimes because there's not really anything to answer to if they do something wrong, especially if it's not something that's like a life threatening type of cyber thing. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. And obviously, looking just at this this research, you know, we also looked at what other simple HTTP servers are running. And we did uncover that there was even a stale one from a Redline Stealer where they were dumping all their data into. So it was interesting to see that. It seems like an interesting artifact, service, whatever, to try to keep an eye on if you have access to Shodan and things to discover these types of services. But then kind of digging into the toolkits and stuff that were kind of being pulled down, which is good because it kind of shows that, you know, the things that we hunt for and the things that we talk about are still relevant, right? Especially if they're using this toolkits or these tools today and these scripts today, then obviously we are already prepared for this. One of the scripts that they basically run, it's just stored in a text file. It uses a PowerShell encoded command to pull down some payloads. It also creates a new user and adds them to local admin accounts. They're also adding or updating the registry keys for the terminal server and allowing remote desktop through the firewall on the host. So they're basically enabling RDP access. And then they also move, a Terra agent, which is a remote admin tool. A lot of actors are now using those types of tools for just additional access or another way in case they get kicked out kind of thing. So we see activity like that. The other thing I love seeing is out of the list of the scripts, there's also single character bat files. I think, you know, we talk about that pretty regularly, is just looking at human behavior around how things are named. The lack of effort as far as naming things and just always making them single characters is an easily identifiable thing, only because most systems for normal things are not named with single characters, or even up to two characters most of the time. So it's a good thing to kind of keep an eye on stuff like that when you're just kind of digging through data for interesting things to find. One of the things I really liked was they really show the effect of when people are trying to not necessarily intricately walk through a network or a system. In this case, when you look at some of these scripts, it's kind of like that smash and grab effect. Like, ooh, they're going to task kill a ton of things. And so one of the things I think is really interesting to look at is just the behavior of when you see multiple executions of the same executable within a short period of time, regardless of what that is. I think that's always interesting. And this kind of shows that as well, because not only are they doing that for task kill, they're doing it for SC, which is what's controlling some of the services where you're basically saying stop or delete different services. And then the other thing that's nice to see as well is when they try to do defense evasion, some of their scripts for defense evasion, they're actually listing out all the registry keys that are associated with Defender and other things, which I know when it comes to configuration of just knowing what's a good configuration or knowing what controls things from a registry perspective, I think threat actors are really good at doing the research, and then you do the research on them and you kind of learn a lot about how your tool sets are controlled or managed kind of on the back end, right? You know, we're used to using GUIs and things. It's really interesting to see that. So then you kind of know what to look for when things get tampered with in that way. They also, I'm assuming this is associated with kind of ransomware-like campaigns because there's a lot of emphasis in scripts around getting rid of backups. They use three different local tools for this. Actually, I should say four. And that's what's also interesting. Like the due diligence of where they're deleting things and the same tool kind of deletes the same thing. It's just a, you know, let's just boil it over and make sure this happens. They use wbadmin to delete backups. They also use wmic with the shadow copy delete. They use the vssadmin, which is pretty common for deleting shadows because that's kind of managing your shadows. And then the bcd edit, trying to prevent things from being recoverable. And then at the end, they kind of do a validation of like listing the shadows, which I think obvious. Now, not only that, but when I talk about threat hunting, I'm always really big about being like, hey, let's be super thorough. If an actor wants to do this specific behavior, what are all the different ways they can? This is a great article for that, a report for that, because they show you, hey, here's the five ways to almost, you know, delete all your shadows, that kind of thing. So then you can kind of make that into one inclusive hunt versus focusing on specific tools performing those actions, which I prefer to do as long as you're able to run it in tool effectively. That's the only other caveat there. Yeah, so I just really recommend people kind of looking like what registry keys are being touched. What are the purposes of these scripts? They do a really good job kind of defining, hey, there's this script, it's named this. It predominantly focuses on X, right? One of the other things I did like was they did have a, you know, how they basically try to open up a share on every single drive that's a common drive letter, and, you know, open access to everyone. That I thought was an interesting script, an easy way to say, okay, we want to be able to move things or use this as maybe a beachhead to get further into the network. Now they're able to say, hey, now there's shares available. We can move things to and from. And if there's multiple drives, there's been multiple executions of that kind of thing. So that also I thought was kind of an interesting thing that I haven't seen as, you know, massively done. And then I've talked about it before on here too, ngrok. It's kind of a way to proxy your traffic in like a reverse way. Basically, you have the machine call out to something, reports that can go out that will then proxy from whatever you have things set up on to wherever you want to connect to. So it's like you can easily connect to something that has to come out first, communicate, which is usually the case, right? Firewalls block incoming traffic, but let things talk out. ngrok allows you to set up that whole service to talk out so that you can then interact with it separately when it's talking to wherever you set up your ngrok server at. So that's kind of like a tunnel tunneling protocol. You can tunnel pretty much over any port you set up for that. So that's also an interesting approach that we've seen before, and it's pretty effective. It's pretty simple. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight some of the interesting artifacts they kind of threw in here. I think it's a great way to look at attack in different segments, and capabilities and behaviors in different segments, and kind of understand like the actual data and the control mechanisms that attackers are looking at in order to achieve their goals. So yeah, I was curious what you thought when you were kind of put some eyes on this.
Well, you swallowed a lot of my bullet points, but I'm going to echo a few of them. No, I mean, I like this article a lot for a couple of reasons. So the DFIR report stuff is always good. But the depth of this, one of the first things I thought was, you know, even a novice security professional can look at this and really get a good idea of some of the methodologies attackers are using very quickly, very straightforward, without a lot of tech background. You can see a lot of the things that they're going after. The bullet point that I wanted to touch on was that, like, using the register keys as an example, I would list out so many different ones that they're looking at with their tool set. Some that I never would have thought about, even with experience, you know. So the depth of the breakout of the research on the tools that they had found are really good, just even from an educational perspective of understanding those methodologies. The other thing that I found kind of interesting is that the breadth of tools would be on something this wide open. And I thought it was really cool that they just did a watch and wait to kind of observe and see the traffic. I think it's a small pivot, but I think, you know, especially from the blue team side, when we're really trying to defend, there's so much emphasis, especially in an operations perspective, to react quickly, mitigate quickly, do things quickly. Very rarely outside of just the security researcher realm do we ever have the opportunity to just observe, to let it be. Let's see what it does. You know, have confidence in your security in depth to be able to kind of just watch what happens and be able to pull more out of it, get more details of what they're trying to accomplish so you can maybe protect yourself down the road. That's something that, you know, I took out of this that maybe is worth echoing to the folks that might be listening to this, that where and when possible, it might be something to consider to try to, you know, make sure you understand your environment, of course. Don't be lackadaisical and let them run wild in your environment. But if you can see what they're trying to accomplish, you might, you know, be really good at killing them at the initial access. But if somebody wants you, somebody really wants to get at you, they're going to keep coming. So if you can identify maybe what they were targeting in a way, I just think that would be really cool. And this demonstrated that for me. So yeah, very good article.
Yeah, I think when you mentioned that, I think that's a good point, because I feel like a lot of the, hey, we need to respond to things right away instead of learn from it, is more about, you know, how comfortable you feel with risk management. Because if you understand the risk effectively, then you probably are more likely to maybe accept a little more risk so that you gain more in the process. But something else to be said, you know, there's a lot of tools out there, and I feel like a lot of security-based tools are not engineered for that concept. They're engineered for identify, stop, right? And it'd be really interesting if there was, you know, a way or to which we can leverage the current tool sets, or tool sets just kind of emerge where it's like, hey, we have identified something and we have the ability to kind of monitor it, but also the flexibility, the second you don't like what you see, you can then stop it with like a one press button type thing, or, you know, we can break all these access, right? Like that would be really cool from an instant response toolkit to say, hey, we want to learn as much as we can, but we have full control over the situation. So you have the confidence to watch and learn in almost a real time fashion, right? And I know that people do a really good job with like dashboarding and data coming in, but it's really hard to build it on the fly, right?
But I think the way tech's going, the way there's all the talk about AI, this is a great use case for the human in the loop and why that could be very valuable, especially if you want to do more advanced, more complex things, allow these more sophisticated tools to deliver data more accurately to you, but put that decision and that observation into that human's hands so they can kind of gather more and you know, both together, you're going to get better results. But yeah.
I mean, imagine like an EDR where you're like, yeah, I don't care where this person authenticates, but if they want to try to run anything that's an EXE as that user, just don't let that EXE run. Like how frustrating that'd be from an attacker perspective. We're like, man, I can literally do anything I want, but this, I can't run this for some reason, right? Like what is getting in the way? Like that understanding, like if you can break different parts of their attack chain. So they have to sit there and you see how they try to work around it too, right? Like if you can just put those hurdles in the way and say, well, what are you going to do now? You know, I think that would be
get a couple steps ahead.
Powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. Right? And then they keep throwing tools at you. So you get more ideas for what they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish, what you can unlock, you know, furthermore, you know, like researchers do, share it back to the community and everybody's smarter and better defended for it.
So yeah, when people start seeing products like that, you know, they heard it here first. All right. Yeah. That's all I got on that. What do you got for us?
The first one I have today is an article from Reason Labs titled New Widespread Extension Trojan Malware Campaign. This one rung home for a couple reasons. Some are inside jokes, some are, I just think it's interesting. But, you know, kind of the overview, Reason Labs research team identified a new widespread polymorphic malware campaign that forcefully installs extensions on endpoints. It's a Trojan malware that contains different deliverables from adware to browser hijacking and even more sophisticated scripts, which deliver local extensions to steal data and execute other commands. The malware is typically delivered via imitation or fake websites, something we see very commonly. And they kind of targeted mostly things that have add-ons for, you know, online video games or additional videos or resources. So Reason Labs is reporting that at least 300,000 users have been affected across both Google Chrome and Microsoft Edge from this. And at the time of the report, AV engines were not detecting this malware. And a lot of community noise was being made from people that were affected by it, trying to understand what was going on. So the common fake websites being used, like I had mentioned, some key ones here, like Roblox, YouTube, VLC, even KeePass, where they were imitating those sites to deliver their payload. Once downloaded, the malware would register a scheduled task to mimic common PowerShell scripts, which is configured to run a PowerShell script itself to pull the payload from a remote C2 server. And the execution details, again, high-level overview here, registry edits to force install browser extensions, and those extensions would redirect search queries to adversary sites, steal data, you know, they would also stop the extension from being able to be disabled, and it would generate a message. This one I actually thought was interesting and weird because it's kind of an immediate identifier, but would generate a message in the browser stating your browser is managed by your organization. It would also disable and remove browser updates and tamper with the local browser LNK files. This will let the malware load additional local extensions. And with those local extensions, they can save local information, send it to C2, maintain further persistence, receive and execute commands from the C2, and inject and load scripts into other pages in your browsers to continue to keep you moving in their direction. So why I found this article interesting, I've come across people on both sides of the aisle where things like extensions and toolbars are minimal threats. I think they have a place, and I sit somewhere in the middle there. And this one was interesting because, you know, you see this large scale campaign that's leveraging this technique. And sometimes I think it goes unlooked. We've seen stuff, and generally it tends to fall in the adware category. But you have to think, you know, and this is a full demonstration, this article, there are more things to be had using this kind of methodology, I think. Personally, I think it might be a little untapped. Now, I know there's layers you have to get to try to accomplish this, and there's different sophisticated additions that would make it more scary. But, you know, ultimately, I just thought this was good. Again, I sit in the middle aisle because I've listened to arguments on both sides of they're useless or we should really pay attention to this. I'm curious what some of your takeaways were.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you see this because it seems like this type of attack is becoming more common, because I feel like we talked about something similar before. I don't know exactly when, but probably within the last month or two, we covered something similar to this, but not exactly this, right? And the one thing that was different from the last one is the last one really focused on the registry key associated with the browser that would basically allow the extension in case that your browser was being managed. So it'd put it in like an exceptions list. And then how they would force install the browser was through the shortcut link. They would add the additional to the target path to basically force the loading of that extension. This one goes even beyond by using registry to actually force the installation of that. And they also set up a scheduled task to almost kind of reset everything up in case anything gets cleared out, like on an hourly basis. But what's interesting about this too is, you know, info stealers are getting in kind of a bigger spotlight, especially after like the Snowflake incident, right? And info stealers, like you've kind of mentioned in the past, like people kind of look at extensions like not that big of a deal. Well, info stealers were kind of looked at the kind of the same way. Like it affects the person. Maybe we should tell them to, hey, keep an eye on your credit cards or whatever. But because of so many SaaS applications, it matters more. And the interesting thing about extensions is not only can you kind of steal data, but you can also manipulate the site that people go to, because it can intercept certain parts of the page and actually, you know, load scripts and other things to run on the page you're actually on. So there's kind of more capability there. And even to go beyond that, you know, when we look at like specific ways to persist on an environment, you know, we're usually looking at like, you know, the typical scheduled tasks, registry keys, that kind of stuff. You know, knowing that one, Edge is a Chromium based browser, and this type of mechanism to kind of load these malicious extensions is all Chromium based. Like this type of techniques, you can't do the same thing for Firefox with like the modifying the LNKs. I don't know about the registry piece, but maybe not. But since Edge is Chromium based, and because especially big companies don't want to manage multiple browsers and they're comfortable because they liked Chrome, Edge Chromium is very similar. They probably would use Edge. This would be very effective, right? Because this is exactly attacking that same surface, which is a large surface since they kind of made Edge. So I think that's interesting as far as like that attack surface. So yeah, I think it goes to say that we're probably going to see more ways to try to steal information. And what's the one way people use information and access information? It's through a web browser most of the time. So yeah, I think it's a very reasonable approach to care about these things. And really, you know, what it comes down to too is how do you manage access? Because that is one of the other control mechanisms to dealing with this type of attack as well, right?
Yep.
But clearly, if you're looking at registry keys to deal with extensions for Chromium-based browsers, you're kind of going to be in a good place. Make sure you have visibility of those, as well as we've talked about scheduled tasks in the past. And then I wonder if I built that yet, but I was going to build something based on the LNK modification. Like if you see it update to the LNK in your desktop or in your start folder or startup or whatever it's called, where you can see in your start menu. Yeah, there we go, start menu. Then, you know, that's another good way to say, hey, something weird has happened. Why are we seeing this updated? Because that should be updated that often either, except for on install, right?
Yeah, and that I'd be curious too, you know, from this one as well, literally parallel to the same. How often are the LNK files within the browser pathway? How often are those updated? Maybe there's avenue there. The persistence too, and then you hit another nail on the head, the move to info stealer, and that being more of a commonality, smash and grab methodology, get the info, sell it on the dark web, make your money. That's like, that was one of the parts that I found interesting about this. This is why I maintain myself in the middle when it comes to toolbars or extensions, things like that. You know, the fact that they're applying this persistence mechanism to not allow you to actually remove the extension. And you've seen like through the article itself, they would talk about how a lot of people are like, hey, I'm deleting the extension and I reboot and it just comes back and blah, you know, the fact that they're taking that approach to control that persistence, you know, it's just interesting. And it's like, hey, yeah, we should pay attention to these. These are possibly our next level, and they might get even worse, but yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously you can associate how you respond to these things based on level of risk, you know, like what individuals is it hitting and that kind of thing. And where do you have your controls around? So, you know, you can kind of, I think you can stay middle ground that way as far as, hey, let's not freak out every time, but we need to be well aware and make sure our investigation is thorough enough to validate what the risk really is when you come across these. But yeah, the one thing I wanted to add too is I did test though, when I was doing some of the LNK stuff, that Sysmon will create an event by modifying, even though it looks like a file create event. It will create an event just modifying the LNK in general, which I wasn't sure, right? If you obviously net new, you create an event, but modifying also will create the same type of event. So just FYI. Yeah. So the next thing I wanted to jump to, which I thought was an interesting topic, And it was a dark reading article. And it was called, SaaS apps present an abbreviated kill chain for attackers. And basically what they were looking at was the App Omni researchers were kind of analyzing attacks on SaaS applications. Or I don't know if that's saying it twice, but they're, SaaS apps. And they're looking through the audit logs where attacks have occurred. And what they basically discovered is they feel like the, commonly known Lockheed Martin kill chain that we apply to explain attacks in a very linear fashion doesn't seem to, is more abbreviated or shortened because they don't have to do all the same steps. So the Lockheed Martin kill chain consists of, you're identifying and reconnaissance, weaponization, delivery, exploitation, installation, command and control, and then actions on objective to basically do the full attack. Now, we know in reality, it's like circular, so it's not this big linear approach, but we usually define attacks that way to help talk to non-technical people, but it usually is all over the place with all those actions. So when they were looking across, I think it's 230 billion normalized audit logs from 24 different SaaS services, and there was like 1.9 million alerts over 6 months to kind of identify attacker tactics, techniques, and procedures in those environments. They kind of, out of those attacks, said, initial access and credential access, then collection and exfiltration. Like that was the chain, right? A lot less going on there. I think what's interesting about this, one is this is effective too, because I don't think you have the same I think the saying it's abbreviated might be maybe premature, because I look at how the work environments have changed, and this is just my opinion, right? Is now you have people working remote at home, and you don't have visibility to what attacks they're fending off at that front before you gain the access in order to get access to the SaaS app, right? When they say initial access and credential access, like there are still things happening before that to get that access. Now let's say maybe they bought it off, a broker or something like that. Well, that broker still did a lot of those actions. So I think those actions still exist. But I think from when you look at the attack as a whole, maybe when you look at just the SaaS app alone, you only really see these four or five steps, right? But yeah, I don't think the attack chain's really shortened. But also I was thinking as well, like depending on what the application is, unless I'm well aware of the app, because maybe I've attacked the app multiple times, I feel like every organization may use the app slightly differently, or where things are stored is slightly different. So there is still some reconnaissance once you land to figure out what it is you want to collect in exfil. And I know recon in the attack kill chain is usually at the beginning, but I still feel like there would be recon. And I don't know if that's kind of being bundled in with the collection phase here. So, like I said, I think it's an interesting concept because it is a different attack surface than your traditional, you get in your environment, you attack like the full stack when it comes to the network, the servers, and then the application sometimes. But I still feel like the visibility, if you're just looking at SaaS audit logs, it's the same thing as if you only had a very narrow view in your environment as far as what you're logging. You might just be missing the other parts of the attack because you don't see it based on where your eyes are, right? So I didn't know what you thought in this whole concept. Like, I like the idea. I guess I'm just not totally bought into it. So I just thought it was an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. So this kind of spins back to things that we've talked about in, in the past weeks. For me, is the SaaS environments are very interesting from my perspective. So I'm going to kind of walk down the line here. So there's a part in the article, quote, he points to two large attacks that App Omni analyzed as examples of how adversaries target SaaS environments. In one of them, the threat actor logged into the IDP using a valid token and then modified the IP ranges that were allowed to authenticate to various applications. In just 10 minutes, the threat actor downloaded more than 100 files from cloud storage and information repositories, end quote. So what this screams to me, and this is one of the things that I just seem very interested in, and it steps away from direct threat hunting, but I'm going to get back there, is the complexities that tend to come with the SaaS environments as far as access control is concerned. it's not always very straightforward. And I think the fact that you can accomplish leveraging only a few parts of the kill chain to get your job done, and not have to go through the whole gamut, I think comes because of that. Just a theory. SaaS environments are generally meant to spin up very fast, speed to market, be able to do a thing, meet a requirement or a compliance thing, keep the business moving, et cetera. And usually, and I've seen it myself very personally in many occasions where you would grant access for an individual to do a thing, and that would actually have embedded accesses to do other things like, hey, I want to give you this access to spin up this application and work on this part of the SaaS environment. But also that allowance that I gave you now lets you do a lot of admin things in the background, like change the IP addresses or do some modifications that you didn't even know as the person that got the access you had. And the person that assigned it might not have known. So like this is very interesting to me because it's alongside of that, I think there are visibility points that when you're deploying SaaS environments are hidden in the same places. So what might be able to log, what telemetry you might be able to get from the SaaS environment, what controls you can put around that, not just the access controls, but where your data sits, how it sits, et cetera. I think a lot of that goes unnoticed too. I think they're both parallels because of the ways a lot of these environments tend to be deployed, they're meant to be speed to market. You're not looking at these things. So it screams to me that like the side where you really want to look is how are we deploying this thing? What is under the hood? Every time I think SaaS, I'm like, okay, I want to know what's under the hood. I know we're not looking at it. Let's look, let's just make sure. But yeah, that was a couple of things that really screamed at me, man.
Well, so you kind of made me think about something as you were talking is, you know, we talk about like why SaaS apps exist and what's great about like the speed to market. And, you know, sometimes it's offloading some risk, right? Because you're like, hey, the application is owned by somebody else. So they're securing the app. Now they're not necessarily securing the access, but what's more interesting about that model is then it puts more onus on if they're securing that side, then you really have to secure your users in order to address that risk. So sometimes when you own the app, you can put enough controls around it yourself to where your users, if they're not great, you can still protect your own app because you understand the risks better.
Right.
The people who build these applications that maybe your business buys into, you know, you don't really have a full understanding of what's being done to control everything. So it's almost like you have to invest now where you might have saved into how do I protect my users better or what do I do about my user space? So I always think it's an interesting paradigm when we talk about like, look how much money we can save or look how much risk we can manage by doing these types of things, but not realizing that, hey, there still is a cost. You're really just shifting where you need to spend your time and money, right? To really still have the same control of the same situation and get the same benefits. So I think what you brought up was pretty valid. And I just thought that was like where my head went, a concept I hadn't really thought about yet. So.
Yeah, and there tends to be on the surface, you know, at least from experience that I have had, where SaaS apps might seem like you cannot see what's happening with them, like the telemetry's not there, right? But it actually, in most cases, you can flip the switch and turn that on pretty quickly. It's just knowing that it's there, look at being able to find it under the hood somewhere in that engine, and it's never right in the front, sometimes not documented well, but most of the time it's there, and it's at least worth exploring. For your sake.
Right. What do you have for us next?
So the next article I have is from Safe Breach. It's titled Windows Downgrade Attack Using Windows Updates. So author Alan Leviev of Safe Breach was researching the state of downgrade attacks on Windows. Which would be basically being able to roll back to previous versions to more susceptible vulnerable versions to then execute vulnerabilities. And he found several vulnerabilities that he was able to use to develop a tool called Windows Downdate, which basically takes over the Windows update process to craft fully undetectable, invisible, persistent, and irreversible downgrades on critical OS components, which in turn allows for privilege escalation and bypass of security features. So again, a high overview. Alan identified that through the Windows update process, a registry key with the actions list path called POQ exec command line or CMD line. It was not trusted installer enforced, which led him to an action list called pending.xml, which, quote, is an XML file that provides the functionality of creating files, deleting files, moving files, hard linking files, creating registry keys and values, deleting keys and values, and much more, end quote. So basically, this would allow him to use a hard link file action to replace the update source destination. From there, a couple steps was all that was needed, setting trusted installer to auto start, adding the pending.xml path and identifier in registry, and bingo, bango, you're done. And this would allow it to be undetectable because it was accomplished in a trusted, legitimate way within Windows. So it would remain invisible because it was updated and allowed the system to think it was fully up to date. And the persistence maintains due to the action list parser called POQExec.exe, which is also not digitally signed. So as a result, he was able to patch it to install empty updates, meaning any newly available updates would be falsely installed. So, I one of the things, and we can go into the weeds here, but one of the things on the top, I thought the research idea, the hypothesis to go after this was really cool. And I kind of haven't thought about downgrade type attacks in quite a while, but basically, you know, Alan went out and said, hey, I'm just curious what this looks like in today's environment. I want to see what's there. And he uncovered something pretty big, I thought. So what do you think, Scott?
So yeah, the downgrade thing kind of made me think of, that's kind of what we use to attack older technology sometimes, you know, and especially when you think about the only way to patch something is upgrade the firmware. Well, and you can basically take old firmware and you can still update to that if you wanted to. And you kind of, and it usually can reduce visibility, security controls, add vulnerabilities, and that kind of thing. The one interesting thing here is I always struggle with, like, look at this crazy thing you could do on a Windows system in an environment, because in my mind, it's like, well, you still have to gain the access to do that. So sometimes I feel like all these attacks always feel easier. Like, oh man, you know, like Eternal Blue was bad because you didn't need to have anything and you owned the system, right? Remotely, whatever, you touched it, you can own it kind of thing. That was the kind of vulnerability that always screams, oh my God, right? But this is what I think is really cool is the level of persistence you can gain, because if you were to profile the system, it still looks patched even though it's vulnerable. I thought that part was crazy. So when you think about really what the risk really means is if you're not able to catch the initial intrusion, it might be really, really, really hard to catch the persistence, right? But I don't see this as a, oh, I'm going to downgrade you so I can attack you perspective, right? Which I think that's where a lot of people kind of go with their heads, like, oh my gosh, you enable all these vulnerabilities. Yeah. The only vulnerabilities that would really matter at that point with the level of access you have, I'm assuming, would be some weird privilege escalation to maybe system, right? Because you should at least have administrative access, I think, do these actions anyways. So you kind of, when you say, oh, look how the vulnerabilities become available, like, what does it matter at that point? Because you don't need the vulnerabilities. But the fact that you can downgrade something and it not be known, because, like, for instance, you know, what a great beachhead if you can downgrade something so that you know it's vulnerable so you can gain access to it anytime, even if you don't have credentials. Like, that's a great way to pop in and out of a network if you get kicked out and stuff like that, from that perspective. So I think that part's kind of interesting. But yeah, I always try to think about when we hear these, like, oh my God things, because this is extremely cool research, is now how will that be utilized? Like, if I was an attacker, what do I gain? What's the net new capability? Or how does this change my workflow or even, you know, attack surface identification, you know, that kind of thing. And sometimes that makes me feel a little better when I go through that process, because I realize, okay, this is bad, but this is manageable because it's kind of more of an edge case, unless, you know, people have really, you know, more attack knowledge than me and can do more creative things than me at this time. But from what I've seen in the past, that's kind of how I look at it.
So I think the scary part, you know, where I think people probably go eyes wide open a little bit, my perspective at least, is if you're downgrading and you're allowing the system to think it's still whatever it is, you can put it to whatever vulnerable version you want for whatever your effort is. So the possibilities are kind of unknown, right? Even you alluded to it, like, what would they do with it? And that's generally makes people freak out a little bit, right? You know, like everything, never approach it with the skies on fire, because there's always different layers to these things, right? And your environment may be a lot more tolerant than others to certain things. Your visibility might be a lot better than others. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was very interesting, the approach to this. And it's just, you know, I think it's awesome from being on the blue team side that there's researchers out there just thinking about these hypotheses. Like, hey, I'm going to go chase this down and figure this out. You know, we try to do that every day, right? And yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's always scary because it seems like anytime someone puts eyes on something, they're able to find something, right?
I feel like
every time there's a researcher, like, yeah, I researched this thing for months and didn't find anything. Like, I don't, maybe they just don't talk about that, but I just feel like that's never the case. But
those don't create good articles, right?
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, like, look how secure this is. Then someone else looks at it and finds I'm not secure. But yeah, I think when you look at attacks like this, if there is a type of attack, if they just achieve that one thing, isn't end all be all, then the good news is there's a lot more activity to look at and find. So, you know, unless it's like something like I said, I use Eternal Blue in the past because someone, it was wormable. Like, usually attacks that can be wormable are kind of the worst, because then it's like how out of hand they can get. And then especially with ransomware in the picture. But yeah, so to speak, you know, really interesting. I wouldn't panic, but it's good to be aware of and then think about what would you do to handle something like this, or identify things leading up to this. So the last article I wanted to kind of touch on or report was from Cybel, and it's called The Double Trouble Latrodectus and ACR Stealer Observed Spreading Via Google Authenticator Phishing Sites. Interesting enough, I don't know what it is about Google Authenticator, but it seems like that is like the number one thing people love to steer people to. But basically, it was a valid, you know, that you pull down a Google Auth setup.exe with a valid signature. Valid signature doesn't really say anything. It's not signed by anything that you care about, but that just is a simple bypass, because some security tools, one of the first steps they look, well, is it signed at all? Just checks that box. The other interesting thing that, you know, we commonly say to look out for are when you look for executables running from either your app data roaming or app data local temp directories, because this is where it drops and unpacks itself to. So this is kind of like a chain event, right? It basically, you run this, it has something that decrypts, decodes, unpacks another executable, which then does that as well for the secondary payload. But it does... Which I thought was also really interesting too, because we always talk about from a phishing perspective, if you can get someone to do something and then get them to kind of forget about it, that's a really effective social engineering attack, because humans are one of the best detectors, and there's nothing better than someone saying, hey, something weird happened, and they're the ones that tell the security team, and that's the trigger, right? Now, I don't think there's enough triggers that happen that way, because people sometimes are scared to say anything. But they pop up a window when you initialize the first execution of the Google Auth setup. And it's a fake window, but it just says, oh, unable to install. So all it's going to do is like, oh, whatever I pulled down to install this is just not working. And the worst case, someone's going to be like, hey, I'm trying to install this. And they call IT and they're like, oh, well, here, we got another version. You can install this. Like, they may not even uncover that it was actually bad. And the other thing I think was interesting was, so the ACR stealer, right? It utilizes a concept called a dead drop resolver for its C2. And really what that means is it uses basically legitimate benign service or platforms. And in this case, using Steam Community. I always find this kind of interesting because it's just like easy to access places. When people are looking at things from a traffic or a reputation perspective, everything's always green and always good. But it's very clear if you actually watch or look at the content that it's not normal content. Like, with one of the posts looks like some sort of base 64 encoded string. Like, no one's going to post that on a forum, right? So I always think it's interesting when people find services they can kind of exploit that way. But the other question comes back to, well, how do you manage your environments depending on what you do as a business? And this is why it's really good to tie those things in and be like, yeah, you really should be using Steam in general on our work stuff, because it has nothing to do with work. And that's why those controls exist. Because in this case, like, you know, this C2, if you don't have those controls in place to kind of manage your people and the scope of work, then you can run into these types of problems. This stealer, it specifically targets the web browsers, email clients, FTP clients, crypto wallets, messengers, VPN client stuff, password managers. And then they also say other software. I think the other software is really interesting because all the other stuff is like traditional, right? And I feel like the others are like, hey, we know there's valuable information in these tools, these applications, or whatever. And so when they call those out, I think that's fascinating just because it gives you an idea of what the actor knows. Maybe they know something you don't know, or maybe it makes sense. Like when I say maybe it makes sense, they're targeting the Snowflake SSH kind of app or config stuff. Obviously, Snowflake thing just happened. They see there's a lot of value there. So yeah, add that to the list. But they also have sticky notes. I thought that was interesting because I don't really normally think about it, but obviously one of the quick thing in Windows, when you want to make a quick note, you can open up sticky notes. Maybe people put passwords in there. Maybe people put sensitive information there, but usually if people put information they want readily accessible. So it's kind of more important-ish. Sometimes NoteZilla, where people are just taking notes in general. MySQL Workbench gets database information that they've been connected to if they are a database admin. Notifier or to-do lists. Which is like interesting to understand, hey, they're scraping kind of what's the person's pattern or life, or what are they actually doing? Because that may help them either parse through the data or help them find what is more interesting in the data perspective, or they may even find additional information they can use as well from those apps. So, I always thought that was interesting. So that was like the stealer side of things, right? The other side, which I thought was interesting, was the Lactor Dectus. It basically was developed by the same developers as the Iced ID malware. And so this was also discussed back in like October 2023. They're very aggressive with their scheduled tasks. They basically run on, it runs on login, and then every 10 minutes is running. So, you know, I was even talking in the chat earlier today, like, thinking about it, man, when you have scheduled tasks that run so frequently or in general, and you have executables and things running from your non-system directories or your program file directories, you know, every time that task runs, it's going to create a new process ID, right? And unless the task is smart enough to say, I'm already running and not create a new process. But if you had a load of process IDs for an executable that's not in one of those normal directories where you usually execute things from, maybe it's worth looking at. I mean, I think it's just a good piece of telemetry to say, hey, either it's something that's misbehaving, or maybe I should at least identify, is there a task associated with this, you know, to kind of start digging further and what to look for. I think that's a good thing to look for, because this is also running out of app data roaming as well. That's where the file gets dropped. But digging in further, you know, one of the things they do to kind of dial in on kind of the C2 activity is they call out some of the functions and things that and behaviors. And sometimes this is informative and it helps you find things, and sometimes it's not. Obviously, they have a lot of collection things that you do as far as getting the process list, system info, what kind of items you have on your desktop, stuff like that. So it's still kind of information collection. But they also have the ability where they can execute a DLL. So now you have run DLL running, DLL with the export given. But the parent process is going to be from this app data roaming. So that might be suspicious in itself. They also can launch CMD, your command prompt, with whatever strings you want to pass to it as well. So now you have this execution chain that's also weird. That would be something interesting to identify. They do run ways to update, download new configs and stuff for their communication, and some stuff to manage that communication. If you're looking at network-based stuff, that might be easier identifiable, but I feel like just the location of where these two different malwares are dropped, as well as some basic behavior, is enough to say, hey, there's something we should look at when you're trying to hunt for these types of artifacts. So thought it was interesting from that perspective. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I found the obfuscation technique of dropping the error message kind of fun. You know, and I had my brain kind of spawning into what could that possibly accomplish. I'm not going to give the bad guys any ideas. I'm gonna leave that alone. One of the main things that I looked at here, quick Google search, because you'd actually went into that. The Google Authenticator is averaging about 4 million downloads a month right now. And that it's, you know, law of averages, right? There's a reason Windows is attacked more than anything, right? Yeah. So that made me think about the side from a defensive perspective of how you could consider
next
proactively looking at what could be in play, right? Like, okay, I use Authenticator, running some basic stats. How widespread is Authenticator? And then it's like, okay, let's put some priority around visibility on this. What could happen on this? Controls around how people will download it. You and I both know, like, there's many, the user is going to user. We're never going to change that. And if you're using a legitimate app and the user has internet access and they might not know the legitimate way to get this, or an authenticator tool might just be new to them or a new type.
Right.
So the first thing they're going to go to is Google, and they're going to download the thing that pops up. And a lot of times that ad is serving up this exact malware. So, like, if you know that you use Google Authenticator and you can understand, like, the methodology behind maybe the attacker psychology here, you could really consider, okay, let's prioritize this as a focus of risk and look at maybe things we can do, because our surface here is big and the surface for this tool is growing more. That was a thought I couldn't get away from. The other part too, I think was interesting, is the Latrodectus is relatively new. October 2023 was when they were, you know, kind of first tagged.
Right.
And the article points out some interesting parts that I thought were in between the weeds of the notice of it evolving from the first time it was identified.
Yeah.
Showing that it's getting more complex. It's getting more sophisticated.
There's encryption
techniques, things like that. It's being maintained. It's being developed. So something worth keeping an eye on, you know, one look at where they might go next, you know, putting the pieces together of what they're trying to accomplish. But yeah, there's just a couple things I had.
No, I like that approach to the proactiveness, because, you know, I think it's very easy to say, hey, what are the top apps or tools people are using in IT, in business, in general, right? If you had that list, then it'd be easy to say, okay, one, you know what the executables are supposed to look like. You know where the download sites should potentially be originating from. And depending on your tool set, it might be as easy as saying, hey, I don't want an executable named this being downloaded from anything other than this. Or let me know if that happens, right? Like, if you can make those ties and stuff like that. And maybe there is some care and feeding, right? You have to figure out how would I manage that as things change or update or whatever. But sometimes just doing that once still saves you, even if it's not perfect solution, right? It saves you time. It also saves you as far as, I mean, I think it's also a great conversation, because there's nothing better than when you talk to leadership when you're in the security space and say, look at the things we've done and the ideas we've had. And so now we can feel better about this space, and these attacks are occurring. And if this exact attack happened, we'd be fine, right? And they love hearing proactive things about what you're doing, not about, hey, yeah, we got attacked 10 times and we saw it, right? That's like, yeah, it's good defense. But like, if you're doing proactive things, then they, you know, they feel like this is why we hired you, right? I don't know what it is about proactive versus sitting and waiting. No one likes anyone that sits and wait on the job, I guess. But yeah.
Personal soapbox. I think that it's like, The defensive side is still so reactive, right? The defense, the blue team side is always reactive. Okay, it happened. Oh, now what we do? Now how we find it? And the idea of hunting in the all the branches that stem from that tree, you know, even if you can't put in controls, maybe your environment's complex, or there's some weird thing that you can't put this specific type of control in because it would impact business function, right?
Right.
Well, maybe there is another way to be proactive, where you consider, okay, we're going to do some research. We're going to maybe hunt to see, not necessarily that it's malicious, but how often does it happen where people pull this thing that we use all the time from its non-standard location, right? And you can kind of start
be Trojanized. They can still be like legitimate, but they can be Trojanized. So now you get both, right?
Right. Yeah. It was very interesting.
All right. Well, I think that kind of closes everything out. So I really just want to thank everyone for joining us, our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And so with that, that closes out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of August 12th, 2024. Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.